Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here.
Reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance.
Like your first home expansion.
Or your first big lightning strike.
There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents.
Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
This podcast is supported by Talkspace.
When my husband came home from his military deployment, readjusting was hard for all of us. Thankfully, I found Talkspace.
Talkspace provides professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatric providers online. Military members, veterans, and their dependents ages 13 and older can get fast access to providers, all from the privacy of their computers or smartphones.
I just answered a few questions online, and Talkspace matched me with a therapist. We meet when it's convenient for me, and I can message her anytime. It was so easy to set up, and they accept TRICARE. Therapy was going so well, my husband and I started seeing a couples therapist through Talkspace, too.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, including TRICARE. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com/military. Go to Talkspace.com/military to get started today. That's Talkspace.com/military.
Beautiful. Okay. And I got to say, Mr. Rosenbaum, that's quite an impressive bookshelf that you're framed by there.
That's just that behind me. If I had it, if it was in the reverse angle, you would see all the film books and,
and my
fireplace and other things. But
yeah. That's it's a good I don't know. I always like when the guest is surrounded by books. Speaks well of the chat to come. And I assume quite a collection you've amassed over the many years.
Yes, and I've got quite a lot, actually. Even more books than I used to have DVDs. So yeah.
Oh wow. Yeah. All right. Well, then if you are ready and Mike, if you are rolling, then we will, we'll just go ahead and do ourselves a show.
Good to go.
Good.
One Heat Minute Productions presents Guide for the Film Fanatic, the podcast where we invite a guest to pick one movie from Danny Perry's seminal 1986 film reference book and talk to us about that movie. I'm your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and across the country from me is my co-host,
Michael Hull.
Our guest today, guys, is quite simply one of the great film critics. He did that job for the Chicago Reader from 1987 to 2008. Before that, he was assistant editor for Monthly Film Bulletin and staff writer for Sight and Sound in London. He is also the author of many essential film books, including Midnight Movies with Jay Hoberman, a personal favorite, Movie Wars, How Hollywood and the Media Limit What Films We Can See, Cinematic Encounters, Interviews and Dialogues, Cinematic Encounters 2, Portraits and Polemics, and his latest, In Dreams Begin Responsibilities, a Jonathan Rosenbaum reader. He is also the subject of the new interview book, Travels in the Cities of Cinema, conducted by Ihsan Koshbacht, which is out now. Say hello to the legendary Mr. Jonathan Rosenbaum. Hello, sir.
Hello.
Thank you so much for taking the time to come on. It really is a thrill as someone who's been reading you for as long as I've had an interest in film criticism. It's really a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
Let's start with a plug. Your most recent book, as I mentioned, is In Dreams Begin Responsibilities, a Jonathan Rosenbaum reader. As the title suggests, it collects writings from the entirety of your long and impressive career. So I guess the main question I want to ask is, how do you go about curating that? What were the criteria for the pieces that you wanted to include in this volume?
Okay, well, basically, all right, first it was I only wanted to include pieces that have not appeared in any of my other books.
Sure. Okay.
Where this differed from my other collections is, for the first time, I wanted to include my literary criticism and my music, which is mainly jazz criticism.
Got it.
And other than that, the only rule I had was to kind of like make it chronological, roughly. I mean, because I didn't know exactly. And so the book actually surprised me while I was putting it together, because I discovered that I had been writing about literature, music, and film concurrently through my whole career. And I didn't realize to what extent I'd been doing that. I mean, making comparisons and so on, and using them in, referring to them in relationship to each other. So in effect, the book actually has a theme, but I didn't even know it had this theme until I started, putting the pieces together.
Oh my God. What an incredible discovery that must have been.
Yeah.
And what is that theme, if we're not giving too much away by going into it?
Well, it's just that there's something, just that there are common sensual and theoretical and intellectual traits between film and music and literature.
Sure.
And that usually, one thing that actually happened to me with this book, which I think is significant, is that there were two university presses I went to with it, mm-hmm. in which the editors wanted to do the book, but the book was rejected by the publicists. And that's was shocking to me, because I had no idea that publicists could have veto power over the editors. But this happened with both University of California Press and Columbia University Press.
Oh my God. And what was their...
Not only that, but in the case of California, they were really nasty about it, because they let me go on thinking they were going to be publishing the book for several months. And then they kind of wrote and said, oh, by the way, we're not doing the book, you know. And that led me in a way to kind of reach a conclusion that maybe I was a cult writer, that in a sense I was wrong, of that somehow they're thinking in terms of mainstream, but their idea is, the Reaganite idea about a market is you take an existing market and you exhaust it. You don't start a new market. And the problem with my book, commercially speaking, is that I'm starting a new market. I guess that would be the least way of describing it.
So the idea being that if it had just been about film, or just been about literature, or just been about music, that would have made it more easily marketable than something ambitious where you're trying to tackle all of those ideas in
that's right.
In conjunction
and you
with
see,
each other?
What I think is something that plagues us all, but we don't talk about it, is capitalist censorship.
Yep.
In other words, if it's not mass market, you can't do it very often. And we talk about having no censorship, but that's not true. It's just that we don't recognize it as censorship, but it is censorship.
Right. Well, and this is something you've been writing about directly with regard to film for quite some time. I mean, literally, I mentioned the title of a book where the subtitle is How Hollywood and the Media Limit What Films We Can See.
Yes, of course.
Do you think these ideas of cultural and capitalist censorship are becoming more prevalent? Are you seeing more of this now than, earlier in your career when you were writing something like Movie Wars?
Well, I don't know, because I never had a collection like this before. So I didn't, it would be impossible for me to speculate because at the same time, I don't really know about whether it's more or less the same, the way it used to be. But I do think this idea about markets can be traced back to Reagan in a certain way. The idea that you take existing markets and you exhaust them, you don't start new markets. At least that's what I associate with Reagan.
Right. No, that scans. Well, I'm glad you found someone who is willing to take a chance on it, because it's an important book, and these ideas are so fascinating. The other sort of big picture question I wanted to ask, and then we'll start talking about the movie. It pains me to say it, because it's my job too, but it feels like we are in a period where film criticism feels less essential than ever before. But it also feels like people have been saying that for as long as I've been paying attention to film criticism. So at risk of asking, the biggest possible question, what do in your eyes is the state of the art now? Is good criticism still out there? Is there an audience for it?
Yes, there's definitely an audience for it, because I have one. I would say there's more good stuff now and there's more bad stuff now.
Mm. There's just, it's and so it's, much easier to publish somewhere that.
Yeah, and there's more films available, and there's more film criticism available, and there's so much stuff that I think, in some ways, you could say it's a reactionary period because people are so flummoxed by so many choices they have that they wind up going for the Oscars, Oscar winners. But at the same time, for those who are more serious and want to dig deeper, it's a golden age because you can get all the stuff that you, before you had to, you could only see if you lived in a, like Paris or New York or London or something. And now it's, sort of like more readily available, even if it's only, online. So I think it's, I think it's always been a social art, but it's become a social art in a different way because people don't usually see films together at the same time, but they discuss them. I think the state of the art is that there's more of everything and that has good aspects and bad aspects.
So as someone who reads a lot of film criticism and is an expert in the field, what would you like to see more of in the film criticism that's being published today?
I'd like to see more of stuff that's not tied to... See, I think there's a certain tendency of the industry to kind of run film criticism and be in charge. So I'd like to see more of people following their own bents, which means, particularly because so much is available, basically deciding, I want to write about Carl Dreyer's Odette or Gertrude or, because I'm interested in it, not because it's something that's being on sale this week. So in other words, I'd like to have, as an art form, to have it further removed, at least for some people, from the marketplace and to not think about the marketplace for a while, because I think that it seems to me that one of the sickest things about this culture right now is that art is considered neurotic and sick and making money is considered healthy, which makes no sense to me. Particularly because if you're making money and you don't even know what you're making money for. I mean, if Donald Trump and Elon Musk decided to put all their money into making beautiful things, I might feel differently towards them in some ways. But it's like they don't even need the money. So, I mean, why are they doing it? And why do we consider it important? And it's reflected on all sides of society. I mean, when people were questioning whether Kennedy was shot by Lee Harvey Oswald, I don't think that was front page news on the New York Times. When Oliver Stone made a movie about it, it suddenly became front page news. So in other words, if rich people are making money off of it, then it becomes news, which is really a kind of stupid, insane situation.
Yes, agreed. Wise words. All right. Well, then let's discuss something a little more noble than that. What film did you select to discuss today?
Carl Dreyer's Odette.
I believe this is a BFI restoration trailer, if I'm not mistaken. The fun thing is that, a portion of our audience will just hear the audio here, so they'll just hear people speaking a language they probably don't speak. But, he's quite mad, thinking he's Jesus.
It's a pretty good trailer in terms of,
it is
giving you a sense of the movie, the characters, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
You always sort of worry, a trailer that was made 50 years after the movie was made,
it's going to be in a different spirit.
Either they're going to make it into something that it actually wasn't, or they've seen the movie enough times to make a really great trailer. It seems to be sort of one or the other.
Yeah, definitely, though, it's the black and white cinematography is well represented. We're seeing some of the camera movement and the long takes, which I know we'll get into a bit in our conversation. And some of the tragedy of it. See, I've since read an essay Mr. Rosenbaum wrote about the film since seeing it. So now while looking at the trailer, I'm seeing a lot of the visual.
That's a good article, man. That's a good essay.
Yeah, it is.
Because, like, you know, I sort of went through all the feelings over the course of just watching the movie once. And the article, like, really carries you through all the different... I mean, starting out, you know, sort of as an 18-year-old trying to watch, I wouldn't have made it to the end. I'm impressed you got through it.
Mm.
You know?
Well, but as I mentioned in the article, when I saw it at the age of 18, it made me really angry. I not only disliked it, I hated it. And
I just want to point out the trailer ends with a quote from Jonathan Rosenbaum. I hadn't noticed this before. There is
Jimmy,
surely
what is the quote mean saying?
Quote, there is surely no other experience in cinema that comes close to it. And that that is definitely the pull quote from that particular essay.
Oh, well, that's certainly true. I certainly still believe that.
Yes, do you see indeed. How ingrained in the culture of Ordet you are? We randomly pulled the trailer
right.
with a quote from you at the end of it. That's beautiful.
Imagine that. So Ordet was the penultimate feature film by the great Danish director Carl Theodor Dreyer, whose previous pictures included Day of Wrath, Vampire, and, of course, The Passion of Joan of Arc. It was based on a play by the Danish playwright and Lutheran pastor, Kaj Munk, whose own story is a rabbit hole well worth going down if you're so inclined. The play premiered in Copenhagen in 1932, and Dreyer attended that premiere and started thinking about a film adaptation quite shortly thereafter. Ordet was released in Denmark in 1955. So this was a movie that had been in his head for 20 plus years and absolutely feels like it. Mike, what did Danny Perry say about Ordet in Guide for the Film Fanatic?
Danny says... Carl Dreyer adapted the play by Kaj Munk about a proud, elderly Christian farmer whose faith in God has all but disappeared because of the lack of miracles in recent times. He tries to mend fences with an old friend who's rejected him because his belief in Christ isn't solemn enough. He does this so that one of his three sons can marry the other man's daughter. Meanwhile, he worries about another son who seems to be out of his mind from reading Kierkegaard because he believes he can communicate with God. The old man and his eldest son suffer tremendous grief when that son's angelic wife dies while giving birth.
Sorry, I'm just going to say, I think that's mistaken because, in fact, he thinks he is God. He is Jesus.
Right.
It's not that he communicates.
There we go.
All right, go ahead.
The old man and his eldest son suffer tremendous grief when that son's angelic wife dies while giving birth. The baby is stillborn. But the crazy son insists that Christ will resurrect her. Theme of film is that people, even priests, shouldn't let faith in God diminish, and that those who are regarded as insane are actually closest to God. Beginning of film is charming due to the simplicity of the sets and the characters. It wouldn't be jarring if June Lockhart, Tommy Redding, and Lassie dropped in for a visit. But picture becomes drawn out and silly. It might work as a story told in church, but as a film, it is far-fetched. Story was also filmed in Sweden in 1943 with the resurrection in that version handled figuratively with Henrik Malberg, Emil Haas Christensen, Preben Lederdorf Rye, Kay Christensen, and Bridget Federspiel.
You know, I probably should have just spared you the agony of all of the names at the end. Okay, so we'll get back to Mr. Perry's thoughts here, but I do want to start with what you get into really beautifully in this essay that you wrote for, I believe, a DVD release a few years ago, and we'll link to that essay in the show notes. But tell those who haven't read it a little bit about your personal history with this particular film, but also I guess with Dreyer himself and the rest of the work.
Well, okay, I don't know if it was the very first film I saw of Dreyer, but in a sense it was, because even if I saw Joan of Arc before that, it was in a lousy print. And I really feel that if you don't see a good print of a Dreyer film, you haven't seen the film. I think it really matters a lot. One of the things that I most people assume about Dreyer, if they look him up, you know, and is most people think, because that's what a lot of the books say, is that he grew up in a strict Lutheran, you know, sort of like household. Totally untrue. Totally untrue. And in fact, Carl Dreyer was illegitimate. He was adopted by these, you know, a printer and his wife, who also had already had adopted another illegitimate child. And Dreyer hated his adopted parents. He was, I mean, one thing I can tell you is that I once had a conversation with a good friend of Dreyer's who was the head of the Danish Cinematheque, a guy named Ib Monty, who told me Dreyer was not religious, or was not certainly very religious at all. So the whole idea that he was a kind of very super religious is wrong. I think that the key to understanding all of his works to me is that they're not about faith, they're about challenges to faith. And they're not about what you believe, but about, in other words, Ordet is, he wants to kind of like convince people that a miracle is possible. But the way he does it even involves a certain kind of subterfuge and cheating, because he does something that he actually, there's a miracle in the film, not at the end, but close to the end, that most people watching the film are completely unaware of. And that's during a long dialogue between Johannes, the son in the family who thinks he's Jesus, and a little girl who's the youngest daughter of the youngest child of the mother, who's dying in the next room. And the camera is moving almost 360 degrees around them. And yet, during this dialogue, the camera never winds up behind them. You only see them frontally or in profile. So it's literally impossible. The only way it could have been done was probably a rotating set in a certain kind of way. But the point is, I think I'm convinced that Dreyer wanted to get the audience to accept a miracle without even knowing that they were accepting a miracle, to prepare them for accepting the miracle at the end of the film. And when I first saw it, I saw it at a radical camp in Tennessee that was really where the civil rights movement was started, the Highlander Folk School, which is where Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks planned the Montgomery bus boycott and so on. It was a great experience for me. It was the summer after I graduated from high school that I went. And they showed a few art films, and this was one I had not seen. And it just made me furious, because I thought it was a movie that sold out its own positions, which were agnosticism. But it took me a while to realize that Dreyer is really made films about inner struggle. It's not about believing that there is a God, that there isn't a God. That isn't the issue. It's much more wrestling with whatever you have and trying to come to terms with it. And so that was, to me, what's unfortunate is that the whole story about Dreyer's, you know, upbringing and, you know, the only real serious biography that was written about him has been published in Danish and French, but not in English. It's really a pity. It was, and it's somewhat a fanatical book, because it's a kind of obsessive book about an obsessive filmmaker. But basically, the section that deals with all the major films is called The Monument to the Mother. That Dreyer, when he was a young man, or when he was late teens, actually traveled to Sweden, which is where he was from. He was actually, his mother was Swedish, not Danish, and tried to find out whatever he could about her. His mother died not long after she found someone to adopt him, because she became pregnant again and tried to abort the baby by swallowing the heads of matches and had a horrible, painful death because of it. I mean, one could see so much of Dreyer's other films are about women who are suffering. And in a way, it has an awful lot to do with his obsession with his mother and his love for his mother, who he never knew, but who died, of course, died before he could ever come to know her, even. So I think that it's a very kind of complicated story, but I mean, I actually, the original film of his that I sort of latched onto, that it's still in some ways my favorite apart from Our Dead, is Gertrude. And Gertrude is the kind of woman who's, I mean, basically you can see all of Dreyer's films as being about good mothers and bad mothers. And Gertrude is both, to make it really complicated. But the emotional complications are what his films are all about.
Yeah.
And being conflicted.
Right. And that really is like, that's a primary preoccupation, it feels like, throughout what is really, it's a very slender filmography. Like that's the thing that I think is important to put across, is that this is a major filmmaker who did not make very many features.
In the silent period.
Right. But in the sound era.
A lot of the silent films are quite remarkable too. I mean, it's not like they're, I mean, even though I think his greatest films are his last, are the last ones, not counting, there was one film he almost like said he even denied making because he hated it so much because he wasn't allowed to have the actors he intended to use. And so therefore for him, it was just a kind of alienated labor, a movie called Two People, but which does exist, but it's not that interesting.
I mean, what I loved about the essay that you wrote and about that initial response was it very closely mirrored the way that I felt initially the first time I saw this film, which was not long ago, which was just a year or two ago. But this, what because I went into it as someone who's a tremendous admirer of The Passion of Joan of Arc. And so I'm very teed up and sort of tuned in to a kind of cynicism is too simplistic of a phrase, but that idea of the damage that dogma and strict religious faith, organized religion, you know, all of the sort of the emotional damage that can be done by holding too fast to these sort of immovable ideas. And there is a lot of that present in this film, the various crises of
the term that Dreyer used was intolerance. All of his films are against intolerance, and that's even true of Gertrude, who's his heroine, who he loves, but who also is a very intolerant character.
Right.
So it's a theme. It's a theme that runs through his work.
Right.
Sorry, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No. Yeah. Thank you for that. Yeah. And so it's so present in this, and we're witnessing, you know, these crises of faith, this emotional brutality and sort of hard-headed stubbornness between various figures, between the two fathers, you know, one who's like, who won't accept this pious man because he doesn't meet his definition of Christianity. There's just so much religious intolerance and almost emotional terrorism. Yeah. And then, but yet, even taking all of that in, there is still room for faith and room for a miracle. And that just caught me so blindsided me the first time that I saw it, that I wasn't sure what to make of it when it happened.
Yeah, no, I think it's a kind of thing that, you know, it's endlessly challenging. To this day, it's always a challenge, you know, in terms of how one accepts it. And, you know, my impression was that the play was done in a way where you could sort of like rationalize or figure out excuses or somehow that she wasn't really dead. And, you know, in other words, of basically using plausible explanations for the miracle at the end. And Dreyer mm-hmm. made a big point of eliminating any possibility of that.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you have to accept it as a miracle, period, full stop. You can't accept it any other way.
Right. I mean, have you read anything or heard anything about why he made that specific change, why he felt it had to be that concrete?
Well, I do know that he did talk about that, you know, the ideas about saying that we don't know as much as we think we do about science, and there are certain ways in which he, in other words, because when certain people complained about that he was juxtaposing religion against science, and he was sort of like refusing that as a description of what he was doing. So he gave that there were kind of like a new age explanations of the miracle, in the sense that there were, you know, in other words, that maybe there's some way of predicting the future. I don't know. He was just saying that there's a lot we don't know.
Sure.
And so that makes it the idea of what we call a miracle possible, just because there's a lot of things about that we don't know, you know, and in terms of but the funny thing was that he was not somebody who went to church. He was not, you know, and that's what was so interesting, that so many, that religious faith and spirituality and all that is so central to the films in certain ways. I mean, it's not even Gertrude, which doesn't have any religious aspect. There's a whole notion of predestination in it, which that somehow Gertrude feels that what's happened to her was predicted in a dream she had, you know, and things like this. So that there's a certain kind of way in which, I don't know. I think that Dreyer, one of the things that's fascinating about, to me, the greatest filmmakers are the filmmakers who reinvent cinema in order to express what they want to express, that there's no other way it can be done. But basically, basically reinvent cinema for that purpose.
Right. Well, and I'm also always fascinated by the sort of the preoccupations, the ideas that a filmmaker lands at late in the career. Like, this is a very different film than the one that Dreyer would have made, you know, immediately after Joan of Arc, or that he would have made shortly, you know, when he first saw the play in the early 1930s, that it does feel like the work of an artist who has lived a long life and whose thinking continues to evolve on these very big ideas, no?
Yeah, and he went through many changes. One thing that I've learned from his biographer, who, by the way, is no longer alive, the Danish guy who wrote the biography, who also wrote articles afterwards. There was a brief period after Joan of Arc and before or during the time of Vampire when Dreyer became gay, actually. And fell in love with actually his cinematographer, the same cinematographer of Vampire and Passion of Joan of Arc. And then he had a nervous breakdown and went to a sanitarium. So, but you know, I don't know about more of it than that, but there are a lot of dark skeletons rattling around in his life. One of his children was lobotomized, for example. He had a daughter who was actually lobotomized, who was, I don't know if it was because of a birth defect or something, but was, and he was obviously a very private person who kind of kept his obsessions to his work and himself. I mean, you know, who didn't talk about these things. But I think the fact that he was, that he didn't want too many people prying around was one reason why there was this misconception that he grew up in a strict Lutheran household, which, I mean, his parents were not religious at all, actually. And when he went to church, it was a French church in order to improve his French. It wasn't the kind of religion.
That's a great reason to go to church.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've talked about, you know, the big ideas, the themes, the narrative here, which are all robust. Talk to us a little bit, especially for maybe those who aren't familiar with Dreyer or with this particular film, about what he's doing formally in this film, what he's doing with, you know, with long takes, with the way that he's shooting and lighting, the look and feel of, and texture of the film that he's trying to accomplish.
One thing that's very important, I think, and this was a kind of camera movement that was first identified and described by David Bordwell, I think the late David Bordwell, in his book on Dreyer. Dreyer had invented a kind of camera movement in which the camera is tracking in one direction and panning in the opposite direction at the same time. And it's very hard to describe, but the effect of it is very peculiar. It's sort of like it has a real... but again, when we're talking about psychological complexity, it seems to me that that's a... You know, that's something that... I mean, in a way, all of Our Dead is about, from the very opening shot, is all about pan shots, moving from left to right or from right to left. But it's sort of like, and it's even binding people together. But sometimes if you're panning and it's possible that, I don't even know how he did that sort of like 360 degree camera movement where the camera movement doesn't ever get behind the characters. You know, like how he did that technically, but I think what's amazing is that it almost like doesn't matter how he did it. The important thing is that he did do it, and the effect that it has. His films are not easy; they're difficult. In other words, I think that they should be people who not only take film seriously but who actually don't mind grappling and struggling with something. It's not about, see, so much of the way commercial cinema works is it's supposed to be totally enveloped in the film while you're watching it, and then you're supposed to forget it as soon as it's over and go on to something else. It's not supposed to stay with you or change you or, you know, and I think that Dreyer is obviously not like that. It's important to say, by the way, that Our Dead was the film I don't know if he had a favorite film, but Our Dead was the film that he felt happiest with in terms of it doing baking it exactly the way he wanted to. Whereas in contrast, even though Gertrude is a great film, he wanted to shoot in color. He couldn't get the money to shoot in color. You know, there were different things that he had to compromise on other films in different ways. One thing that's very alarming about Day of Wrath is that it was rejected by most of his fellow Danes.
Oh, geez.
And not liked. But the Nazis loved it.
Oh, no.
I mean, he was even invited to move from Denmark to, you know, I mean, to work, make films for the German film industry. And he was so upset by this, he actually moved to Sweden for the rest of the war. I mean, you know, he actually got out of Denmark, you know, but yeah, it was, he actually had a lot of Nazi fans.
Oh dear. Oh dear. That's the,
what you do you do with that? I
mean, yeah.
When you're soft and dry, you're facing nothing but complexity.
challenges clean up and down the line.
Yeah.
I should ask you, you mentioned that this was, this may have been sort of your introduction to his work. Where did you kind of go from here in terms of taking in the work and understanding and appreciating it?
Well, I think when I saw, I mean, this was 61 that I saw, when I saw Our Dead, and I guess it was, I can't remember the year of Gertrude, but I think that was 64 maybe, or 63. Anyway, I liked Gertrude when I saw it. I wasn't bowled over by it, but I was really intrigued by it. And it's one that I've always liked. In fact, the only one of his films that I've probably, you know, have liked from the get-go, you know, but at the same time, understanding it took me years, actually. And I actually, the piece I wrote about Gertrude argues that Gertrude is a non-narrative character and all the other characters in the film belong to a narrative, but she is unchanging. And it's almost like Dreyer's concept of his mother, that, you know, before you're born, you're in a non-narrative universe. And then when you die, after you die, you're in a non-narrative universe.
And right.
Associated Gertrude with that somehow, which I think is quite fascinating. And anyway, my piece about Gertrude is trying to get into some of the ramifications of that.
Got it. All right. Well, we'll track that down and link that as well.
It's always surprising me, and I can always, for me, the best sign of a great filmmaker is someone you could see their works again and they're like seeing them for the first time. They're not, mm-hmm. they don't get redundant or boring. They're constantly revealing new facets of themselves. So that's a facet I certainly find in Dreyer's work.
That totally makes sense. Okay. Well, let's take a quick break and then we'll talk about the movie's release and reception. All right, friends, let's talk about the release and reception of Odette, which opened in Denmark in January of 1955, but did not make its way to the States until nearly 3 years later, opening in New York City on December 14th, 1957. Also playing in New York on that day, Pal Joey, Peyton Place, Love in the Afternoon, Jerry Lewis as the Sad Sack, Richard Burton as Alexander the Great, Kirk Douglas as the Indian Fighter, Mickey Rooney as Babyface Nelson, Marlon Brando in Sayonara, Doris Day in The Pajama Game, Anthony Quinn in both Wild as the Wind and The Hunchback of Notre Dame, Gene Kelly in Les Girls, Joanne Woodward in Three Faces of Eve, and at the Paris Theater, which is thankfully still with us, Brigitte Bardot in Roger Vadim's And God Created Woman. Mike, what were the news headlines on that day?
Saturday, December 14, 1957, Dateline, Paris, France. National big deal paper Le Monde has published a report on the French atrocities in Algeria. Not much to be proud of there. Mm-hmm. Of course, the conclusion was that the civilized Frenchmen were just driven mad by the savagery of the Algerians. No of comment course. On how they may have been driven mad on their own.
Right.
Front page of the New York Times is a story about two guys who are arguing over a pistol. Okay, picture this. Two guys on the street, New York City, arguing over a pistol. A street cop sees them, comes walking up. They've got a gun between them, and they're both yanking on it. He decides not to bother about whose gun it is. He just arrested both of them. But the three-judge panel of state judges is persuaded that, to quote the paper of record, four hands on the gun was too many. And so the court declared them both innocent. Because they couldn't decide whose it was. And afterward, the judge asked either man if they wanted to claim the gun. They both declined. That's a great story. There's a really good writer could make that into the perfect short story.
There we go.
Finally, December 14, 1957, we are deep in the Cold War. It's just a couple months after the launch of Sputnik, which was still big news in the United States. We were very upset about that whole Sputnik thing, losing the race to of the course. Satellites, etc. According to the Times, there was some scuttlebutt going around D.C. that we would have beat them to the stars were it not for some of these Dixiecrat fucks who kept putting the brakes on the army. Because they decided that using your own internal scientists and engineers to build rockets was creeping socialism. And so they kept telling the army that they needed to hire private contractors. And the army was like, this is sort of needs to be top secret. So there was a fight happening between Democrats and the army. And as you know, when shitty people fight, everybody loses. That's headlines.
That's true.
Jason, what did the critics have to say about Odette?
Well, in the New York Times, Howard Thompson wrote This Kingsley International release, which opens Saturday, is an experience, not a show, and certainly no entertainment, a visual sermon of scalding spiritual intensity. It uncoils when it moves at all like a majestic snail, drier novices are warned. But, he continued, framing a superlative cast in the simplest of settings, he has evoked a rigid but powerful blend of speeches and faces, the Dreyer trademark. Both emotionally and intellectually, the picture is hypnotic, and some portions will nail the spectator to his seat. Good quote. Over at the New York Herald Tribune, William K. Zinser called it, quote, a drama of astonishing purity. It has an austere strength that is rarely found on the screen. But he also buffered his praise with warnings for 1957 audiences, writing, few directors would dare to be so unhurried in a medium that reveres motion. In fact, the film is often dull for this reason. But Dreyer is doing exactly what he wants to do, and his actors always gel into patterns that are meaningful and dramatic. And in film culture, the late, great Jonas Mekas opined, by any standards, Odette is a highly accomplished work of cinematic art. Dreyer's formal and technical mastery, the seeming simplicity of his style, and the depth of the film are overpowering. However, Odette is in no way a modern film, neither in strict nor in a popular sense, and viewed in an atmosphere of cool jazz, supermarkets, and satellites could be easily misunderstood despite its artistry, the more since it comes to America preceded by reviews of several European critics who have called it a fraud, who have accused Dreyer of mysticism and of believing of miracles in the age of science. This is some of what you were mentioning, Mr. Rosenbaum.
One way I differ from Jonas about this is that, you know, Dreyer is one of the few people who it's almost impossible to see him in relationship to the times he was living in. I mean, Odette does not seem to me in any way, it's not, you know, you could say it's not modernist, but it's not old-fashioned either. It seems to me that, in other words, there's a certain kind of way in which Dreyer is so far alone by himself and doing what he's doing that you can't call him, you know, like modernist, but you can't call him pre-modernist or post-modernist, mm-hmm. or, you know, it's like he's invented his own rules.
When did Joan of Arc come out?
That was in the late 28, 29.
Right, the Roaring 20s, right, yeah. I think it was called, right, when Joan of Arc came out. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
Guy's not concerned with your calendar.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like definitely he was in a world of his own. Whenever he was doing this, even though, you know, he made, you know, there were things that actually dealt with issues of the day. I mean, there was, he made a film against anti-Semitism. He made films that were feminist also. But by and large, they were not films that were addressing what one might sort of say the issues of the day, at least not in any obvious way.
Right, exactly. We do always try to find a detractor even among a film as praised as this one, and I did find one. Pauline Kael wrote, Odette, which the world press greeted as his masterpiece, may be considerably less than that. Continuing, some of us may find it difficult to accept the holy madman protagonist, driven insane by too close of study of Kierkegaard, and even more difficult to accept Dreyer's use of the protagonist's home as a stage set for numerous entrances and exits, and altogether impossible to get involved in the factional strife between bright, happy Christianity and dark, gloomy Christianity, represented as they are by people sitting around drinking vast quantities of coffee. End quote.
Well, actually, one thing I want to comment on that's an interesting thing about the Dreyer's intentions and the way he made the film is that he went out of his way to make the character of Johannes as irritating as possible.
Yes.
He was modeled on a person who was literally insane,
right,
who Dreyer to meet in an insane asylum. And a lot of people who criticize the performance ignore the fact that he was doing exactly what Dreyer asked him to do, right, as an actor.
Right.
And so that Dreyer doesn't make anything easy.
Right.
You know, so in a sense, he was sort of like making it even harder, because the point is that, you know, the funny thing is that, you know, that people talk about saying he's closer to God than people who were conventionally religious. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe so, but then at the end of the film, he's a different character. He's not the same character that we've been watching before. He seems right. quite lucid. He's like, you know, it's like, and the funny thing is that the motivation of his insanity was, part of it was removed by Dreyer from the play. In the play, mm-hmm. he goes to see a play with his fiance.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually had a theme similar to that of Ordette. And they're quarreling about it when they left. And then there was, basically, she pushed him out of the way to prevent him from getting run over, and she was run over.
Mm-hmm.
So in effect, he felt responsible for her death and all of this. So there's all of that, and there's also an awful lot of theological debates that go on in the play that Dreyer also eliminated. So, mm-hmm. I mean, the whole idea that as if Dreyer wanted us to find him acceptable and he wasn't acceptable. I mean, the trouble with Pauline is that she was always looking at it from a mainstream vantage point, and there's no right. mainstream vantage point that you can say anything meaningful, it seems to me, mm-hmm. about or not.
Yeah. Yeah,
you have
agreed.
To sort of climb inside the movie and then look out at us in order to get some kind of sense of what it's doing.
Well said. Well said. How did Ordette do in terms of box office and awards, Mike?
Ordette was quite commercially successful, especially in its native Denmark, and did well on the international art house circuit. It also won the Golden Lion at the 16th Venice International Film Festival, shared the Golden Globe for Best Foreign Language Film, and won the National Board of Review Award for Best Foreign Film. More recently, it was placed at number 16 in the Village Voice's 1999 Best of the Century poll, and placed 19th in the Director's poll and 24th in the Critics poll of the 2012 Sight and Sound list. Pretty good.
All
yeah,
right.
Yeah, no,
folks.
It seems to me that actually it was the most successful of Dreyer's films critically, actually.
Yeah. And
you know, those Sight and Sound heathens, they're going to vote for it. I mean, that must be a good movie.
There you have it. All right. Well, now it's time for a segment we call Double It Up, where we each select one movie that we think would make an ideal double feature with today's focal film. Mr. Rosenbaum, you're our guest, which means you go first. What would you pair Ordette with for an evening's entertainment?
Inside the Yellow Cocoon Shell. That's a Vietnamese film made about okay. 2 years ago. That's it's a mind-boggling film. It's very, I guess you could say it's religious and spiritual. It's full of paradoxes. It's very hard to describe. It's very beautiful. So I don't know. There are not many films I think that you can sort of like associate Ordette with, but that would come the closest for me.
Beautiful. I went with a much more predictable and obvious pick, as I frequently do. But I do think it's fascinating to watch this movie in conversation with The Passion of Joan of Arc. I think when you're talking again about sort of early in a career versus late in a career, the thematic preoccupations that are recurring, that he's interrogating again, that he's perhaps coming up with different conclusions about. And also, they strike me as really starkly different films aesthetically, that so much of Joan of Arc, of course, is in these beautiful, intense, tight close-ups, and it's a very crisply edited picture. And as you discussed earlier, this one is working much more in looser medium wides, moving camera, much less editing happening in this, and yet still achieving a really striking beauty. And so I don't know. I think they're films that have a lot to say to each other and also a lot to say when taken together. Mike, what's your pick?
So for me, a lot of times, like if I read something and it's, if I read a book and it is impactful enough on me, I can't read another book for weeks, or like not another like serious book. Like I have to read like mystery novels or some shit. And I used to not understand this, but I've come to realize that what I'm actually doing is just still thinking about the thing that impacted me so heavily before. Right. And I need some time to sort of just consume bullshit because I'm still thinking about that. So I'm going to say that at the end of Ordet, you don't need to watch another movie that's going to make you think. You're going to need time to think about Ordet. So don't double it up with something that's going to. So I'm going to recommend actually Ocean's 11, because the Soderbergh movie, simply because like I can't imagine a movie that's more easy to watch than the Steven Soderbergh Ocean's movies. Have got to be the easiest movies to watch in the history of movies. They're beautiful. Everybody's beautiful. All the dialogue is perfect. Everything clicks together exactly like you want it to. You don't really have to think. You're not going to figure out anyway. Fuck it. Like, just dig it. You know there what you I go. Mean? It's like, it's the easiest movie to watch. So you can sit there and just enjoy a thing in front of your face that you don't have to pay that much attention to. And also, you've seen it 50 fucking times already. So you can sit there and think about Ordet for the rest of your evening, which is what you're actually going to need and want to do anyway.
I could also suggest Blazing Saddles. As a
there you
Blazing
go.
Blazing Saddles. Yeah. My other choice was maybe Coffee and Cigarettes, but that was more of sort of a style, an atmospheric thing, really, than anything else. Yeah. I gotta say, bro, like I need a pipe that buttons to my fucking jacket. The pipe game in this movie was immaculate. Yeah. You know, the coffee game. I'm sure the set smelled amazing. So Coffee and Cigarettes is a nice alternate option if you've seen, but only because if you've seen Ocean's 11 at least 100 times. All right, that's it.
There we go. Mr. Rosenbaum, the book again is In Dreams Begin Responsibility. It's a Jonathan Rosenbaum reader. It is available wherever fine books are sold. Where can people read your work online these days?
JonathanRosenbaum.net.
A fantastic resource filled with some of the best goddamn film writing you'll come across.
Also, at the top of it right now, there's an article of reflections of the March on Montgomery from being a teenager and part of the civil rights. And that is like, I went to read some film criticism and then I read a breakdown of the American psyche that I was not entirely prepared for. There's some really good stuff on there. In addition, I mean, the film criticism is top shelf, but you know that people paid you for all of that. There's some other stuff on there that is also really, really fantastic and sort of goes into some sort of aspects of, you know, American history and psyche that
I should say that I've always regarded myself as a writer first and as a film critic second.
I do too after reading that Montgomery piece. Holy shit. Wow.
All right. I'm Jason Dash Bailey on Blue Sky and Letterboxd. Mike, where can people find you?
I am Fifth Column Films on Instagram and Blue Sky.
And of course, if you like the show and think other people might like it too, please do leave us a rating and or review on your podcatcher of choice. You can join the mailing list for weekly show notes at buttondown.email/filmfanatic. And if you're one of those weirdos who likes to watch videos of people recording a podcast, you'll find us on YouTube on our channel, Guide for the Film Fanatic. And oh yes, my latest book, Gandolfini, Jim Tony and the Life of a Legend, is on the shelves now.
All right, hold on a minute. We're not just going to blaze past that. Jason has a brand new book about Gandolfini.
It'll have been out a long time by the time this comes out. We'll plug it elsewhere. It's fine.
Will it have been out for six months yet? No, we're going to have a special episode. I'm declaring it now, where we talk about Gandolfini movies. I'm not sure how it's going to work, but I'm just going to say it anyway. Our humblest thanks. There we go. To our guiding light, Mr. Danny Perry, author of Guide for the Film Fanatic, and shout out to executive producer Blake Howard, who is perpetually 27 and incurably mad.
Thank you again, Jonathan Rosenbaum.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening. On the next Guide for the Film Fanatic, John Bleasdale, author of The Magic Hours, The Films and Hidden Life of Terrence Malick, joins us to discuss Days of Heaven. See you then.
Hey, baseball fans, it's time to swing big on your bets this season. Step up to the plate with an odds boost token from BetMGM, an official sports betting partner of Major League Baseball. No opt-in is required. Just log into your BetMGM account to receive your odds boost token. Then, place a bet on any MLB game and activate your token. If your boosted bet hits, you'll score a bigger payout, no matter the showdown. BetMGM is your betting home for baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotion offer not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369. For Arizona, call 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary and expire in 1 to 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.